From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Raby, sitting in for John Horn. Today, KPCC's pop culture expert Mike Rowe takes us inside the changing world of Comic-Con. Then, the documentary Game Girls, life on Skid Row through the eyes of a lesbian couple struggling to get out.
Most people in L.A. drive through Skid Row and see Skid Row through the car window, but don't really go beyond that. So it was really important for me to create an experience where now people know names, know a story.
And we'll tell you the six fictional female Russian spies who'd put Maria Butina to shame. All that's coming up on The Frame. Comic-Con, the biggest comic book and pop culture event of the year, is underway at the San Diego Convention Center. It's a chance for fans to gather and dress like their favorite characters. It's also where Hollywood studios interact with fans and sell them on their latest products. And it's where fans talk about the big news in pop culture, like, can you guess why there's an uproar over the new Doctor Who?
All of this is new to me. New faces, new worlds. New times.
We'll have the answer in just a second. Also, DC Universe and Disney both unveiled new TV shows to promote their new streaming platforms, while HBO and Marvel are sitting it out this year. The arts and entertainment editor for LAS.com, Mike Rowe, is at Comic-Con, and I asked him why HBO and Marvel didn't come this year.
One of the big panels every year is the Marvel panel, where they always show their new movies, what's going to happen next. But after Infinity War and how big that was, they sort of took a step back, letting people relax a little bit. But I think it's sort of given an opportunity for other shows, other movies to start having an impact, for people to notice other things and actually go see a little more of the convention. It's not everybody is just waiting out all day in that one room trying to see Marvel. They're trying to see a little bit more of what's happening here.
And HBO, too?
HBO as well. Westworld's taking the year off. Game of Thrones is taking the year off. But that doesn't mean that the TV networks don't think there's something to get from the fans here at Comic-Con. I actually sat in a panel for Magnum PI the other day, which is a show you don't really think of with Comic-Con, but they were thinking, the nostalgia factor and really going after fans who may remember that show here.
I'm wearing my Detroit Tigers hat right now, by the way.
Fabulous.
But my mustache will never be as beautiful and luxurious as Tom Selleck's.
Well, the new Magnum PI doesn't have a mustache, so there's definitely some controversy there.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of controversy, the new Doctor Who is female. That was just announced recently. How's that going over among the fans at Comic-Con?
It's a big deal this year at Comic-Con. There's a lot of people are very excited about cosplaying as the new female Doctor Who. She made a surprise appearance. There's a sort of geek fashion show they have here every year for fashion, for fans. And she made an appearance in the fashion show in full costume and sold fans on the fact that everybody should cosplay this, not just women, saying that, you're not cosplaying as a man or a woman. You're cosplaying as the Doctor. And so you should be proud of that, which I thought was really interesting. It seems like fans are very much taking to it, and the actress has been all over Comic-Con being very engaging with the fans.
Joss Whedon has a new comic book.
Yeah, Joss Whedon, he's been taking a little time away. He's finished doing the Marvel movies, then he did the reshoots on the Justice League movie, and he just signed a new TV show, but they announced this morning he's also going to be doing a comic book. It's a sequel to his very popular, groundbreaking web series, Dr. Horrible, and that's coming out this fall. It's sort of a chance to do more in that world. They did a reunion panel this morning with everybody from Dr. Horrible, and Neil Patrick Harris was the one actor from it who didn't show up because he's got plenty of other projects in the fire.
Why is Whedon doing a new comic book when comic books are struggling right now?
I think that everybody's trying to do more to reach out to new audiences. Different industries are trying to reach out to fans. Comic books are... I went to a panel the other day with the publishers of DC Comics, and they admitted, they said that comic books are a mature industry, which basically means it's not growing, and that means they have to find new ways to reach fans. DC Comics is launching a new streaming service called DC Universe. They're going to be going directly to fans. It's going to have both TV shows and movies, but something that's very fresh and new for us. Streaming service, the comic books are going to be available right on the service, so you can read through comic books on your TV. And it's a sort of interesting way to try to bring people in with the movies and TV shows, but then also get them hooked on the comics as well.
Hey, what's up with Star Wars?
Oh, Star Wars. One of the big announcements this year, you know, nothing about the movies came out, but the popular animated series Clone Wars, it was canceled a while ago. They've done some other cartoons in the meantime, but they announced they are bringing Clone Wars back. They had a big hashtag for it. They're talking about Clone Wars Reborn, and it's going to be back. It sort of shows that the opportunities to having streaming services gives to the studios to have something new, have people be able to watch a show that seems like it was dead, seemed like it was on its last legs, but they're bringing it back because it was a very popular, cultural, critically acclaimed show, and they're giving it a chance to come back because I think that's the way they can really sell people on getting like a streaming service, because this is going to be a streaming show. So that way, shows that have hardcore fans, they can get people to plunk down their $10 a month or whatever to sign up.
What is Taco Bell up to there?
Taco Bell did one of, they call these offsites where there's stuff that's not really part of the convention, but they have these experiences you can go to, you can see what, and they, so they brought this Taco Bell from the movie Demolition Man, takes place in the future, so it's like the Taco Bell of the future. You can go inside, it's sort of a fully realized experience. They have, it's a full four-course meal inside of there. It really makes you feel like you're inside the movie. I think that the studios have realized that they can have a bigger impact by giving fans experiences rather than just giving them swag and giving them giveaways. They can have people see things like this. They put it on social media. Gets everybody talking about, of all things, Taco Bell on Twitter. So it's sort of the way that they can reach fans and have that go beyond just the Comic-Con people who are here.
In the future, will hard-shell tacos still cut the roof of your mouth when you eat them?
No matter what, you're not going to be able to improve on the taco. It's going to be what it is, even in 2062.
What other crazy things are you seeing?
One of the craziest things I saw so far is I went to a press panel for DC Comics, and they put all of the members of the press in robes and gave us a fake spa experience. So, you know, there's some benefits to coming here as a member of the press.
Like a pedicure? Like what?
Yeah, they just put us all in robes. They gave us frozen grapes and then had us interview the creators at that panel.
Are you still wearing the robe?
Thankfully not. I'm still managing to sweat, though, from having to walk all over the place all throughout San Diego.
Thank you for that lasting image.
Thank you so much, John.
Mike Rowe, the arts and entertainment editor for LAist.com. Coming up, who are the best female Russian spies in film and TV? Plus, a gritty look into LA's Skid Row. That's on the way on The Frame. There are 54,000 homeless people in L.A. County. The new documentary Game Girls takes that incomprehensible number down to two, following the story of Terry Rogers and Tiana Vince, a lesbian couple living on L.A.'s Skid Row and trying to get out. When we meet them in Game Girls, Tiana has just been released from jail. Terry, who struggles with alcohol and mental health issues, is determined to find them housing as far away from Skid Row as possible. Their relationship is tender and volatile. The documentary is directed by the Polish-born Alina Skaszewska. In 2006, she moved into a cheap residential hotel in downtown L.A. and started filming.
I had made films on Skid Row before, so I think in a way it was a very long process to get to it. I made a documentary feature that was essentially about my neighbors as I lived in an SRO hotel myself on Skid Row at the time. And my neighbors were basically all men, so I wanted to do a film about women, even starting back then. And that's initially how I started thinking about Game Girls, that it was supposed to be a film about women on Skid Row. Now, I didn't really, I felt like it was a little bit more complicated to actually do something about the women. I needed something that was more of an authentic representation.
More authentic than what?
More authentic than what you would usually see women, the way you would usually see women represented on Skid Row, which very easily can go into this kind of victim portrayal. I really wanted to avoid that. And I also wanted to avoid portraying women as people defined by their quirkiness, which is also another way to sort of portray people on Skid Row. So I didn't want that. I wanted sort of something that was complex and that really showed people in their entirety, like in their entire humanity. So I thought doing something around a relationship would be a good way to accomplish that, because it's something that people can, anybody can relate to.
Yeah, everybody falls in love and has difficult or easy relationships. So how'd you find Terry and Tiana?
I met Terry on the first day of the workshops that we organized on Skid Row. So essentially, in order to achieve this more complex portrait of women on Skid Row, I wanted to do it in a more collaborative way with the women. And I started these workshops, free weekly workshops for women on Skid Row, expressive arts workshop that were facilitated by a drama therapist, wonderful woman, Dr. Mimi Savage. And on the first day, we had about 30 women come through, and Terry was one of them. And she kept coming to the workshop. And that is how I initially met her.
At these workshops, from what we see in the movie anyway, the women are given various objects, little toys, really, and they have to make up narratives about them and say what it means.
So, walk us through your world.
So it's like red because it's like emergency. We had a state of emergency down here on Skid Row.
So the base.
Yeah, the base. And then this is me, a scorpion, and it's black because I guess it's like been through a lot of fire.
What does that do for you? What does it do for the narrative?
So that was one of the techniques that Mimi used, and it is something that is very often used in therapy, art therapy with children, actually. Sand tray play. It's like it's a very known technique. For me, that worked really well for the film, and Mimi was always laughing at me, the drama therapist. She was laughing because she said, oh, really, that's what you want, the little figurines? But I said, yes, it's actually great for film because the miniature is something that I can blow up big in the film, and that really has the impact and really tells the story because it's visual. But the purpose of the workshop was really to have the women develop the story from their authentic perspective and for me to kind of get the feedback to know that what I'm saying, that what I'm showing in the film makes sense in a larger context for them, that it's authentic to the environment, that it's authentic to the community, and that it also shows the depth of their experience.
Because you're not from Skid Row.
I am not from Skid Row, no. I am from Poland, and I grew up in Germany. I've lived in L.A. for 13 years now, and I did spend time on Skid Row, but not in that way, because for me it was a choice to move into an SRO hotel and have that experience, because it's just something that I wanted to do. Most people in L.A. drive through Skid Row and see Skid Row through the car window, but don't really go beyond that. So it was really important for me to kind of break through that car window and create an experience where now people know names, know a story, and won't be able to look at Skid Row the same way after seeing that film, because you know the people and you know the stories.
So you settled on telling the story of Terry and Tiana, this black lesbian couple. How long did you follow them?
I followed them for 3.5 years, essentially. I mean, I've started with Terry because she's the one who came to the workshop initially, and they started their relationship while the workshops were happening, while we were filming, and it really became the core of the film. Tiana, I had met actually before on the street, so I knew them both separately to some extent, and it was funny seeing them then together, and it seemed like, oh, okay, things are really coming together. This is the film. It was a little bit of a epiphany kind of moment, because they do come from slightly different worlds in a way. Skid Row is a stratified place as well. I mean, there's different groups and people that, you know, don't necessarily intermingle.
Terry's from where and Tiana's from where in Terry's that stratification?
Terry's a little bit more from the outside. She's somebody who came to Skid Row, but comes from a little bit of a different family background. She grew up in a family that was Jehovah's Witnesses and was sort of, you know, had to leave home for those reasons. And Tiana kind of never really had a home to begin with. She went into foster care very early on with her little brother, came to Skid Row much earlier than Terry already. Yeah, so she really has been much more embedded in the community and grew up surrounded by a group of other women in Skid Row, and it's a little bit kind of like her family almost with Tiana.
I haven't had any sleep since the day you went to jail. So.
Baby, you about to get plenty of sleep. I'ma just be up. Because I got 24 hours, 23, 24, 26 hours, whatever. I got all the sleep I needed. That's all we do is sleep. I miss seeing the streets.
Was it hard to convince them to let you follow them?
Terry was the one to convince me to follow her.
Oh, really?
No, Terry really, really wanted the story to be told. She was the one who was very, very passionate about it. And Tiana kind of, you know, came in and out depending on her mood. So Terry was the driving force behind the whole thing.
Why?
I think because it was very, very important for her to be seen and to have the story be heard. And for her, it's really important that this film is not about feeling sorry for anybody. She does not want the audience to feel sorry for her or anybody else really in the film. This is about having your voice being taken seriously and being seen and heard and having your perspective validated on screen.
Why did you take the non-narrative approach?
You mean not making a feature, like a narrative feature, writing it in a...
No, not you could have done a narrative documentary and said, you know, this is Skid Row, Los Angeles, and da-da-da-da-da,
oh,
and this is the two characters.
Right.
And
exactly.
You don't.
Right, yeah. There's no exposition, really. There's no voiceover. There is no kind of voice that's of the author in that way. That was really important for me because I wanted the audience to just kind of be thrown into the situation and have to sort of think for themselves and really just feel and start a conversation. Even the confusion is to me a positive aspect because I'm trying to sort of jolt people out of those preconceived notions about what Skid Row is. And it's not supposed to be this kind of informative, sad movie. It's supposed to really be an experience. So I didn't want to make the film as if I knew something more or if there was a voice outside of, you know, the authentic voices of the women on the street speaking and knowing something else. They do not. They are the ones who know and they are the ones who run the story. So that was really important for me. So everything is kind of created in order to support that.
The movie ends without telling us exactly what happens with Terry and Tiana. Can you tell us? Are they together?
They are not together right now. They went their separate paths, and we'll see.
Have you been at a screening where, you know, Terry and or Tiana are there, the audience applauds at the end?
Yes. So we had the first screening here in Los Angeles this Sunday, and it was amazing. First off, they hadn't seen each other in a little while. But they were both there, and there was just a little bit of tension in the beginning, but it dissipated very quickly. Everybody was really positive. Everybody was really supportive. Some of their friends were there. And just seeing the film with them and with people from the community took it to this whole other level, because sometimes when people watch this particular movie by themselves, they get so impacted by the sort of harshness of it.
I mean,
it is. But there really is a levity in it too. There really is a humor in it that people who are from communities like Skid Row pick up on, because you have to be able to switch very quickly between tragedy and comedy if you've experienced trauma and if you have to continue to go on, and if you're in a place like Skid Row, it's a survival mechanism. And so people really are able to do that. And that humor, as they were laughing throughout the screening, really made it possible for the rest of the audience to also laugh and experience the movie on these two different levels. And they're complementary, but it's very, very important to be able to also laugh about things. Yeah, seeing them together was great. And I think it was a very, very impactful moment for them that they are still processing right now.
Alina, thanks very much for coming on The Frame.
Thanks so much, John. It was fun. It was a pleasure.
Alina Skashevska, director of the documentary Game Girls, in screening Sunday at the Regal Cinemas at LA Live as part of Outfest. I'm John Raby. Here's your assignment while we take a quick break. Who are your favorite female Russian spies on TV and in the movies? Our top six coming up on The Frame. ...29-year-old Maria Butini pleaded not guilty this week to charges she was a Russian spy trying to influence our presidential election. Very unspy-like, she's left a long trail in the media.
My story is simple. My father is a hunter. I was born in Siberia.
Wait a minute. You were born in Siberia?
Absolutely, yes.
You know that you're a first Siberian guest on the Eric Metaxas show?
Oh, wow. No, I'm very proud of that.
Amazing.
Butina is a far cry from the great fictional female Russian spies. Tim Cogshell, a regular on KPCC's Film Week, joins me in the studio now with his list of the best female Russian spies in movies or TV. Tim Cogshell, it's great to see you.
Good to see you, John. I'm looking for Michael Simonovich Ironov.
I am Michael Simonovich Ironov.
I'm Nina Ivanovna Yakushova, envoy extraordinary, acting on the direct orders of Comrade Commissar Rosinin.
Number one has to be Greta Garbo in Ninotchka from 1939.
And interesting in that it precedes the Cold War, actually precedes World War II, which means that the concerns of the movie are not the concerns of the movie that come after the Cold War, although they are still geopolitical. I see Greta Garbo in that movie.
What a charming idea for Moscow to surprise us with a lady, comrade.
If we had known, we would have greeted you with flowers.
Don't make an issue of my womanhood.
But in that movie, the notion is that she can be broken by love. As we move forward, that notion goes away in these films.
We're talking with Tim Cogshill about the best female Russian spies, and I totally forgot about Angela Lansbury.
Ah, Angela Lansbury in The Manchurian Candidate. Now, this is interesting because we're right at the top of the Cold War now, and the concerns of the Cold War are what are at hand. And the idea of being broken by love, oh, that goes out the window in this movie.
And Johnny will really hit those microphones and those cameras with blood all over him, fighting off anyone who tries to help him, defending America even if it means his own death, rallying a nation of television viewers into hysteria to sweep us up into the White House with powers that will make martial law seem like anarchy.
This deep, deep, deep cover spy that Angela Lansbury is playing, which will foreshadow the Americans, which I know we're going to talk about in a little while. This deep cover spy cannot be broken by love, not the love of her husband, not even the love of her own son.
And she would eat Maria Butina for lunch and dinner.
Oh. And plus she had a way better cover story. You know, she's fantastic. She's married to a senator.
Angela Lansbury as Eleanor Shaw in The Manchurian Candidate in 1962. Then Lottie Lenya as Rosa Klebb in From Russia with Love in 1963.
And then you have had the three lovers.
What is the purpose of such an intimate question?
You are not here to ask questions. You forget to whom you're speaking.
We're still in the Cold War, and those concerns are still there. This is a little bit funnier. All of the ideas of that icy, cold Russian female spy is condensed into this tiny little woman in this uniform with these orthopedic shoes she probably don't even need. And there you have the quintessential Russian spy that we're going to see in sort of comic terms for the next 20 years or so.
We fast forward to 2010. Salt.
You're good. But I'm officially off duty, so
you can tell the rest of your little story to one of my colleagues.
Salt.
Yes.
The name of the Russian agent is Salt.
My name is Evelyn Salt.
Then you are a Russian spy.
Very interesting. Angelina Jolie, who is playing ostensibly a CIA agent, who might be a Russian spy. But might not be a Russian spy, but might be a Russian spy, but might not be a Russian spy. And that's a really sort of interesting way to couch these things. It's not so much about the Cold War anymore. That's all gone. It's about some of the concerns that we have today.
What did Air Force General Wacker tell you when you were a staff sergeant at a missile base in Iowa about Russians and spies?
The Russians. Hey, General Rudolph E. Wacker, commander of the 42nd Air Division, whom I loved and worked for, once told me, Tim, all the Russians are spies.
Then 2018, Red Sparrow, Jennifer Lawrence.
Interesting. Jennifer Lawrence in a movie that was not well received, and I think I know why. Right in the middle of the Me Too moment, here comes Jennifer Lawrence playing this Russian spy who has no agency.
I was told to take a man to a hotel. They said he was an enemy of the state.
Take off your dress.
And in exchange, my mother would get the doctor she needed. Instead, they cut his throat.
She's ostensibly a ballerina. She's recruited into the service by her uncle, who's a strong man. And she's handled by all these other men, these Russian spy masters. And she's good at what she does. But she's not the kind of Russian spy that we can respect in terms of a female. She's simply doing what the men tell her to do. Unlike some of the other wonderful Russian spies that we see, like a wonderful Kerry Russell in The Americans on television.
If I said anything that made them think, if I said anything that would... It would have been so long ago.
What did you tell them?
I told them that you liked it here too much.
Now, this is a female Russian spy who has agency. She has agency over all the other Russian spies, including her husband. And what they do, this television series is set in the 80s, by the way, I was right smack in the middle of the Air Force, in my Air Force career, when this is set, Ronald Reagan and all of that. And I got to tell you, you watch this show, and it feels so true to the day.
You know, my dad was in military intelligence. Not quite a spy. He worked in Berlin in the early 50s, and he talks about going to the movies with a bunch of other intelligence agents, many of whom were probably actually spies, in the movies in Berlin or Heidelberg or someplace, and they're watching some spy movie, and everybody's laughing because all the spies are doing it wrong. They're talking on telephones. They're giving away all kinds of secret information. They're talking loudly in restaurants.
Oh, it's nothing worse than a bad spy. The young spy that we were talking about before, Miss Butina, she is a lousy spy. Bad spycraft, sis. Bad spycraft.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you so much, John.
Tim Cogshell is a regular on KPCC's Film Week and critic at large for altfilmguide.com.
You used to say live and let live. If this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in a cry, say live and let die.
And that's our show for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett. Our intern is Maria Alexa Cavanaugh, and our engineer is Valentino Rivera. I'm John Raby. Have a great weekend, and join us back here on Monday.